You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Marwan Moasher, Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace and Director of the Middle East Program. I want to welcome you today to Carnegie and thank you for joining us for this timely discussion on U.S. efforts to disrupt the financial networks that support the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, what is called ISIL. I see there is enough interest in the room for this issue. It's an overflow. While considerable public attention has focused on the military efforts to degrade ISIL in Iraq and Syria, there is another effort being led by the Treasury Department, which is focused on shutting down the flow of money to ISIL from outside sources and through smuggling networks running through neighboring countries. It has been estimated that ISIL currently produces over 50,000 barrels of oil per day, which, once sold on the black market, can provide between $1 and $2 million per day in revenue. This money is in addition to the funds the group collects from activities such as extortion, kidnapping, and illegal surcharges. It should be no surprise that ISIL is now considered the world's wealthiest and most financially sophisticated terrorist organization. To discuss the U.S. strategy to try to cut off these funds, we are honored to have David Cohen with us today. Mr. Cohen is the Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence at the Treasury Department, where he leads the department in enforcement, regulatory, and intelligence functions aimed at identifying and disrupting financial support to international terrorist organizations and other illicit actors posing a threat to national security. He will discuss the terrorist financing challenge posed by ISIL, the group's sources of revenue, and the measures the Treasury Department and other U.S. agencies are taking to address the threat. Following his remarks, we will open the floor for questions from the audience. For those of you who want to join the conversation online, we will be live tweeting this event using the hashtag #DisruptingISIL, one word. So please join me in welcoming Treasury Undersecretary David Cohen.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Dr. Moasher, for that kind introduction, and to the Carnegie Endowment for hosting me here today. It's truly an honor to have the opportunity to lend my voice to the ongoing dialogue fostered by Carnegie and its Middle East Studies program. Before I begin my remarks, I'd like to take a moment to note our sympathy and prayers are with the people of Canada during this difficult time. We're still working on gathering all the information about the attacks yesterday, and are working very intensively with our Canadian counterparts. This is a tragic reminder of the need to remain vigilant in the face of terror. As President Obama has made clear to Prime Minister Harper, that our friends in Ottawa will have whatever support they need from our national security teams here in the United States. I come this morning to discuss an especially pernicious expression of the endemic problem of violent extremism, the terrorist group known as the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. In particular, I will describe the U.S. and international effort my team at Treasury is leading to undermine ISIL's financial strength as part of the comprehensive strategy to disrupt, degrade, and ultimately defeat ISIL. Let me begin by briefly reviewing why we are so focused on ISIL. ISIL terrorists have slaughtered thousands of innocent people who did not subscribe to their warped ideology. They have persecuted religious minorities and threatened genocide. They enslave and rape women and girls. They have brutally murdered aid workers and journalists who traveled to Syria just to bring a small measure of relief to the Syrian people or to tell their story. And the vast majority of their victims are Muslims, Sunni and Shia alike. As it sows chaos in communities across Iraq and Syria, ISIL threatens core U.S. interests. It threatens American personnel and facilities in Iraq. It threatens our regional allies, including Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon, who are already strained by the ripple effects of the crisis in Syria. And because it is attracting so many foreign fighters, destabilizing an entire region, and securing a safe haven, ISIL, if left unchecked, could ultimately pose a direct threat to citizens of the United States and our allies outside the Middle East. Put simply, a terrorist organization with territorial ambitions and a stated desire to kill innocent people abroad must be confronted. That is why, under the leadership of President Obama, the international community has come together to stop this threat. The president has tapped General John Allen as special envoy to spearhead the establishment of a broad coalition, now some 60 partners strong, ranging from the Middle East to Europe and beyond, behind a strategy to degrade ISIL's capabilities, roll back its recent gains, and ultimately defeat it. ISIL has grabbed the world's attention for its outlandish ambitions and astounding brutality, but also for another reason, its substantial wealth. ISIL's primary funding tactics enable it today to generate tens of millions of dollars per month. Those tactics include the sale of stolen oil, the ransoming of kidnapped victims, theft and extortion from the people it currently dominates, and to a lesser extent, donations from supporters outside of Syria and Iraq. So as part of the United States' broader strategy to degrade and defeat ISIL, we at the Treasury Department are intensifying our focus on undermining ISIL's finances. This is a whole-of-government effort, and while we take the lead on the financial component of the strategy, we are working closely with our counterparts in the State Department, the Department of Defense, law enforcement, and the intelligence community. And we are also linked up with international counterparts. Indeed, just last Friday, we hosted a meeting with the State Department that brought together over 20 countries and organizations to identify financial measures to financially isolate and undermine ISIL, as well as the al-Nusra Front and the illegitimate Assad regime. As with the rest of the campaign against ISIL, our efforts to combat its financing will take time. We have no silver bullet, no secret weapon to empty ISIL's coffers overnight. This will be a sustained fight, and we are in the early stages. But one thing is certain. So long as ISIL terrorizes the people of Iraq and Syria, imperils the broader Middle East, and threatens U.S. interests overseas and at home, we will remain committed to degrading its financial strength. In 2004, the office I lead in the Treasury Department was created and charged with developing and deploying financial tools to combat terrorist financing, reflecting the recognition that one way to forestall terrorist attacks is to deprive terrorist organizations of money. Through the application of powerful national and international sanctions, close cooperation with foreign partners in the private sector, and enhancements to international financial transparency, we have made it harder than ever for terrorist groups to raise, move, store, and use funds. In many respects, our campaign against ISIL's financial foundation will build on our work over the past 10 years and closely resemble our previous campaigns. But to some extent, ISIL poses a different terrorist financing challenge. It has amassed wealth at an unprecedented pace, and its revenue sources have a different composition from those of many other terrorist organizations. Unlike, for instance, core al-Qaeda, ISIL derives a relatively small share of its funds from deep-pocket donors, and thus does not depend principally on moving money across international borders. Instead, ISIL obtains the vast majority of its revenues through local criminal and terrorist activities. So just as ISIL relies in part on new models to fund itself, we too are adapting our tools and techniques to combat ISIL's financial activities. Before turning to the specific steps we are taking, let me take a moment to detail these sources of revenue. First, ISIL has raised a significant amount of money, many millions of dollars, from selling oil it extracts from fields in Syria and Iraq. Our best understanding is that ISIL has tapped into long-standing and deeply rooted black markets, connecting traders in and around the area. After extracting the oil,
ISIL sells it to smugglers who, in turn, transport the oil outside of ISIL's strongholds. These smugglers move oil in a variety of ways, from relatively sizable tankers to smaller containers. We also understand that ISIL controls oil refineries of various sizes and output capacities, and earns some revenue from the sale of refined petroleum products. So who ultimately is buying this oil? According to our information, as of last month, ISIL was selling oil at substantially discounted prices to a variety of middlemen, including some from Turkey, who then transported the oil to be resold. It also appears that some of the oil emanating from territory where ISIL operates has been sold to Kurds in Iraq and then resold into Turkey. And in a further indication of the Assad regime's depravity, it seems that the Syrian government has made an arrangement to purchase oil from ISIL. It is difficult to get precise revenue estimates on the value to ISIL of these transactions in light of the murky nature of the market. But we estimate that beginning in mid-June, ISIL has earned approximately $1 million a day from these oil sales. There are good indications, however, that recent coalition military efforts have begun to impair ISIL's ability to generate revenue from oil smuggling. Airstrikes on ISIL oil refineries are threatening ISIL's supply networks and depriving it of fuel to sell or to use itself. Moreover, our partners in the region, including Turkey and the Kurdistan regional government, are committed to preventing ISIL-derived oil from crossing their borders. And last week, the International Energy Agency reported that ISIL's ability to produce, refine, and smuggle oil had been significantly hampered. Second, ISIL also kidnaps innocent civilians to profit from ransoms paid to obtain their release. ISIL did not pioneer kidnapping for ransom. It has been around for thousands of years. And other terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda's affiliates in Yemen and North Africa, also rely on ransom payments as a key revenue source. And as I have said before, kidnapping for ransom is one of the most significant terrorist financing threats today. For ISIL, these ransom payments are irregular, but each one can be a significant boon. This spring, ISIL released captured journalists and other hostages from several European countries. In return, according to press reports, ISIL received several multi-million dollar payments. All in all, ISIL has taken in at least $20 million in ransoms this year. Third, like its predecessor, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, ISIL raises money, up to several million dollars per month, through a sophisticated extortion racket. In Iraq and Syria, ISIL extracts payments from those who pass through, conduct business in, or simply seek to live in territory where it operates. In the Iraqi city of Mosul, for instance, accounts have surfaced of ISIL terrorists going home to home, business to business, demanding cash at gunpoint. A grocery store owner who refused to pay was warmed with a bomb outside his shop. Others who have not paid have seen their relatives kidnapped. Religious minorities have been forced to pay special tributes. We've seen reports that when customers make cash withdrawals from local banks where ISIL operates, ISIL has demanded as much as 10% of the value. Make no mistake, this is not taxation in return for services or even real protection. It is theft, pure and simple. The money ISIL pilfers is being exchanged not for a guarantee of safety, but for the temporary absence of harm. Fourth, ISIL also profits from a range of other criminal activities. They rob banks. They lay waste to thousands of years of civilization in Iraq and Syria by looting and selling antiquities. They steal livestock and crops from farmers. And despicably, they sell abducted girls and women as sex slaves. Finally, as I mentioned earlier, ISIL derives some funding from wealthy donors. Even though ISIL currently does not rely heavily on external donor networks, it maintains important links to financiers in the Gulf, as a spate of Treasury designations last month made clear. So ISIL's revenue streams are, to be sure, diverse and deep. With the important exception of some state-sponsored terrorist organizations, ISIL is probably the best-funded terrorist organization we have confronted. Nonetheless, understanding that this effort will take time, dedication, and broad collaboration, we are well positioned to degrade ISIL's financial strength. Our strategy involves three mutually supportive elements. First, we are working to disrupt ISIL's revenue streams in order to deny it money in the first place. Second, we aim to limit what ISIL can do with the funds it collects by restricting its access to the international financial system. And finally, we will continue to impose sanctions on ISIL's senior leadership and financial facilitators to disrupt their ability to operate. Let me elaborate. The first element of our strategy is working to cut off ISIL's main sources of funding, in particular, its revenue from oil sales, ransom payments, extortion and crime, and support from foreign donors. To disrupt the market in oil derived from ISIL-controlled fields, we will target for financial sanctions anyone who trades in ISIL's stolen oil. It is true, of course, that ISIL's oil moves in illicit networks that are largely outside the formal economy, where individuals are less vulnerable to financial pressure. But at some point, the oil is acquired by someone who operates in the legitimate economy and who makes use of the financial system. He has a bank account. His business may be financed. His trucks may be insured. His facilities may be licensed. All that makes ISIL oil facilitators vulnerable. The middlemen, traders, refiners, transport companies, and anyone else that handles ISIL's oil should know that we are hard at work identifying them and that we have the tools at hand to stop them. We not only can cut them off from the U.S. financial system and freeze their assets, but we can also make it very difficult for them to find a bank anywhere that will touch their money or process their transactions. In combating ISIL's fundraising through oil sales, we will leverage the well-established reluctance of banks around the world to facilitate the financing of terrorism. And beyond financial sanctions, we are working closely with others in the U.S. government to enhance the ability of our partners in the region to choke off cross-border oil smuggling routes and to identify those involved in the smuggling networks. The Turkish and Iraqi Kurdish authorities have both made commitments to combat whatever oil smuggling occurs in their territory. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, our military colleagues are playing a significant role in degrading this source of funding through airstrikes on oil-related targets. Next, to prevent ISIL from raising funds through ransoms, we are redoubling our efforts to translate the emerging international consensus against the payment of ransoms to terrorist groups into a more widely adopted practice. It has been U.S. policy for many years to refuse the payment of ransoms or make other concessions to hostage takers. This policy rests on the sound premise, confirmed by experience, that an explicit and consistently applied no-concessions policy reduces the frequency of kidnappings by eliminating the underlying incentive to take hostages in the first place. In the context of hostage taking by terrorists, this policy has even greater force. We know that terrorist organizations, ISIL included, use ransom money to fund the full range of their violent activities. Refusing to pay ransoms to terrorists, therefore, not only makes it less likely that Americans will be taken hostage, but it also deprives terrorists of funding critical to their deadly aspirations and operations. We maintain this policy not because we are cold-hearted. To the contrary, at the president's direction, we use all of our military, intelligence, law enforcement, and diplomatic capabilities to secure the release of American hostages. The attempt made this summer by U.S. forces to rescue hostages being held by ISIL reflects this commitment. But very simply, if we are to protect our citizens and avoid bankrolling our adversary, every country must adopt and implement a no-ransoms policy. This norm is beginning to take shape. Last year, the G8 unequivocally rejected the payment of ransoms to terrorists, and this year, members of the UN Security Council have twice adopted resolutions reaffirming their shared commitment to seek the safe release of hostages without making monetary or political concessions. Going forward, as we seek to prevent kidnappings from occurring and remain dedicated to freeing those taken, we will continue to urge partner nations to subscribe to a no-ransoms policy. At the same time, we will look to use our counterterrorism sanctions authorities against those who demand or receive ransoms on behalf of terrorist organizations. We are also concerned about external donor networks. To prevent ISIL from raising funds from donors abroad, we will continue to identify its financial supporters and target them for sanctions. We have long focused on disrupting the funding networks of ISIL and its predecessor, AQI. In fact, we have applied sanctions against more than 24 individuals associated with AQI or ISIL over the past 10 or so years. And we will continue to target those who would exploit the suffering of innocent people in Syria and Iraq to raise money for their extremist agendas, whether in support of ISIL or any other terrorist group. In the months ahead, we plan to accelerate our efforts to identify targets for sanctions and take actions against them through our counterterrorism authorities. In September, President Obama led the UN Security Council in unanimously passing a binding resolution to stem the flow of foreign terrorist fighters into and out of Iraq and Syria. Security Council Resolution 2178 aims specifically to prevent and suppress the flow of foreign fighters and money to ISIL and al-Nusra Front, and we are working with others to implement it swiftly. And we are working especially closely with our friends in the Gulf, who are stalwart partners in the anti-ISIL coalition, to ensure that they all have the tools in place to combat terrorist financing and that they all use these tools effectively. We especially appreciate the close collaboration and strong steps taken by the Emiratis and the Saudis to combat ISIL financing. Even though ISIL does not currently rely heavily on the traditional donor model for terrorist financing, that is no reason to relax our efforts in this area. Particularly as we make progress in disrupting ISIL's current sources of income, and as ISIL gains additional prominence in the global terrorist movement, we must be prepared for the possibility that wealthy extremists will increasingly seek to fund it. As for disrupting the revenue that ISIL generates from extortion and other local criminal activities, we recognize that Treasury's tools are not particularly well-suited to the task. We can and we will identify and designate the individuals who oversee ISIL's extortion networks, calling attention to those who are brutalizing the people of Iraq and Syria. But our experience in combating AQI's extortion networks, which ISIL mimics, drives home the point that shutting down the revenue flow from ISIL's extortion networks ultimately will require breaking its hold on territory. Other lines of effort in the anti-ISIL coalition are focused on this crucial objective. Nonetheless, even where Treasury's financial tools cannot cut off certain revenue streams, we still have a crucial role to play. And that brings me to the second key element of our strategy. As we work to disrupt ISIL's sources of income, we are focused on restricting ISIL's access to the international financial system in order to impair its ability to collect funds from abroad and to move, store, and use the funds it acquires locally. ISIL's ability to make the most effective use of the money that it raises depends on access to the banking system in Syria, Iraq, and internationally. Operating entirely in cash is both cumbersome and risky. Cash is bulky, vulnerable to theft, and requires complicated logistics to transport. Moreover, ISIL will have a hard time funding external operations, including facilitating the movements of foreign fighters, without access to the international financial system. So to that end, we are working to limit ISIL's ability to transact through the Iraqi, Syrian, and international banking systems. Scores of bank branches are located in territories where ISIL currently operates. Through cooperation with the Iraqi authorities, bank headquarters, and the international financial community, we aim to prevent ISIL from using those bank branches. The private sector is also playing a key role in this element of our strategy. Bank Secrecy Act reports filed with the Treasury by financial institutions provide the U.S. government with valuable insight into financial activity in areas where ISIL operates. We carefully review these reports for indications of ISIL financing and quickly disseminate information to the appropriate authorities. The third element of our strategy draws on our time-tested approach to countering the financing of terrorism. That is, we will continue to dismantle ISIL's financial foundation through targeting for designation its leadership, supporters, and financial facilitators. Running a terrorist organization, especially one that, like ISIL, spans hundreds of miles, is both costly and bureaucratically challenging. In order to keep track of all its revenues and costs, ISIL depends on complex management networks with CFO-like figures at the top. As we identify the individuals that make up those networks, we will expose and designate them. We've seen from our fight against Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations that sanctioning top officials hampers their ability to raise and handle funds. Doing so against ISIL will make it harder for ISIL to conduct commercial and financial activity, and also clearly identifies for the international community who stands behind this evil organization. We have already stepped up our designations of ISIL officials, both those based in Iraq and Syria, and their financial supporters outside the area. Most recently, on September 24th, Treasury sanctioned two high-profile individuals associated with ISIL, a financial facilitator who arranged a $2 million donation from the Gulf, and a senior military commander. Both were based in Syria, soliciting donations, procuring military equipment, and recruiting foreign fighters to ISIL's areas. These designations will not, on their own, stop these individuals from operating, but they and the designations to come will frustrate ISIL's ability to attract money and fighters. So before concluding, I'd like to make one final point about our campaign against ISIL's financial foundation. We should not confuse funding with financial strength. While ISIL today is well-funded, a terrorist group's overall financial strength turns not just on its income, but also on its expenses and, importantly, the degree to which it can dedicate its resources to violent purposes. And in that regard, ISIL operates within certain real constraints. ISIL's territorial ambitions are a financial burden. Attempting to govern the cities, towns, and sprawling territory in Iraq and Syria where it currently operates, much less delivering some modicum of services to the millions of people it seeks to subjugate, is expensive. By way of comparison only, since no one expects ISIL to deliver the same level of services as the legitimate Iraqi government, the official Iraqi budget this year for the provinces where ISIL currently operates is well over $2 billion. That far outstrips ISIL's revenue and does not include the price tag for the territory it seeks to dominate in Syria. What this means is that ISIL cannot possibly meet the most basic needs of the people it seeks to rule. In fact, we are already seeing reports of water and electricity shortages in Mosul as ISIL fails to deliver. As we make progress in diminishing ISIL's revenues and its freedom to use them, we will further exploit this vulnerability. The consequences of ISIL's inability to meet the cost of governing, by the way, were articulated very well in a recent report by Mona Alami in SADA, Carnegie's online journal for its Middle East program. With time, patience, and close international cooperation, the steps I have outlined today will help undermine ISIL's financial foundation. I must stress again, however, that the campaign against ISIL's finances will require more than just financial tools. This is primarily because, given that ISIL is enriching itself locally, cutting off one key source of funds will require dislodging it from territory in which it operates. But more broadly, even as this vital military campaign progresses, we recognize that the only solutions to the conflicts in Iraq and Syria are political in nature. The hateful ideology propagated by ISIL must be countered by tolerant, economically vibrant societies, and governments that rule in an inclusive manner. These are long-term goals that the United States is deeply committed to fostering. So while we work toward lasting solutions, Treasury will continue to deploy innovative strategies to disrupt ISIL's financing. Together with our partners in the U.S. government and across the globe, we will degrade and ultimately defeat ISIL. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Undersecretary Cohen. Let me start the discussion with a couple of questions, and then we'll open it up to the audience. You just returned from a trip to Qatar and Saudi Arabia, both members of the anti-ISIL coalition, and both countries where individuals continue to donate money to ISIL. What was your message to them, and how do you assess the state of fundraising in the Gulf for such organizations?
That's right. I just last week was in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar. Look, the Gulf is enormously important in the anti-ISIL coalition for a whole host of reasons, including the counter-financing aspect of this. And, you know, I think we have made no secret over the years of our concerns with financing for terrorist organizations coming out of the Gulf. And I think we have made some significant progress in the Gulf, but there's obviously more work to be done. You know, I think if you go through sort of each critical country individually, if you look at Saudi Arabia, for instance, my meetings there were very, very good. The Saudis are, I think, deeply committed to ensuring to the best of their ability that no money goes to ISIL or al-Qaeda or al-Nusra Front. They have really, over the last number of years, made enormous strides in combating terrorist financing, and I'm confident are completely committed to ensuring that ISIL is not able to raise funds in the kingdom. In the UAE, I think I didn't visit the UAE on this most recent trip, but I'm a frequent visitor. They also are steadfastly committed to preventing funding for ISIL, for al-Nusra Front. You know, we have a very good, close relationship with the Emiratis in combating terrorist financing. In fact, we have just initiated a bilateral terrorist financing task force with the Emiratis, where we're going to work together even more closely on combating terrorist financing. I think that's a very positive development, and one I think that reflects an ongoing commitment by the Emiratis to combat terrorist financing. With respect to Qatar and Kuwait, I didn't make it to Kuwait on this most recent trip, although General Allen, who is spearheading this overall effort, is I think just embarking on a tour that will include Kuwait as well as Qatar. I have in the past noted that both Qatar and Kuwait are permissive jurisdictions for terrorist financing, and have raised some specific concerns with respect to al-Nusra Front and to some extent ISIL. I think both countries have more work to do. In Qatar, where I was last week, I had very good meetings with senior leadership, we discussed how best to address this problem. The Qataris, the emir recently promulgated a new law regarding charitable activity in Qatar as a way to try and ensure that the charitable sector is not used as a mechanism to fund terrorist organizations. But there are U.S. and U.N. designated terrorist financiers in Qatar that have not been acted against under Qatari law. Khalifa al-Subai and more recently Abdulrahman al-Nuaimi, who was we designated last December, the UN designated I think in August, are both resident in Qatar. With respect to Kuwait, they are also home to a number of US and UN designated terrorist financiers. They also have the laws and the institutions in place to combat terrorist financing in Kuwait. But one of the things that we are particularly concerned about, and two of the recent designees, Hajjaj Al-Ami and Sharif Al-Ajmi, both were raising funds through social media, through Twitter appeals in particular. And they're raising funds not necessarily from within Kuwait, but are also reaching out to others, including in Saudi Arabia. to make appeals to raise funds. And so one of the areas where, you know, we are quite concerned is ensuring that, you know, in particular, people who have been designated by the U.S. and by the U.N. Are disrupted and unable to continue their fundraising activities. You know, as I say, I think there's more work to do both in Qatar and Kuwait. We have been, you know, deeply engaged with both countries for a number of years. We have seen, you know, others make really substantial progress in combating terrorist financing, and we're going to continue to work as closely as possible with our partners in the Gulf on this issue.
How would you address critics of U.S. policy who suggest that this is not America's fight and that it should be better left to countries in the region and not to the United States? And how do you see the campaign progressing in the months and years ahead? What would you look for to determine whether the strategy is working or not?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. I mean, first of all, this is certainly America's fight to some extent. I mean, as I noted, what ISIL is doing threatens, you know, core U.S. interests, whether it's our personnel and facilities in Iraq and, you know, in Baghdad and in Erbil, or the interests of some of our, you know, very close partners in the region, Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey. You know, it is a very significant U.S. interest. And as well as the concern that, you know, ISIL is attempting to create a safe haven for, you know, for terrorism, you know, across that sweep of territory, which is attracting foreign fighters. I think, you know, we have seen something on the order of 15,000 foreign fighters flow into the area from 80 or so different countries, including dozens of Americans. And so it is deeply in our interest to confront ISIL, combat ISIL, and degrade and defeat ISIL. But it's not our fight alone. And I think the size of the anti-ISIL coalition, this, you know, 60 countries and organizations, you know, coming together to combat ISIL, 10 of which are involved in military strikes, you know, I think demonstrates that this is viewed quite properly as a threat to, you know, really to many, many countries around the world. And then as to how we will judge the success of our particular efforts to address ISIL financing, as I said, this is going to be a long-term effort, and it's going to involve, you know, work that the Treasury Department does in designations, in exposing the networks. It'll involve work of partners in other countries, in Turkey and elsewhere, where we're, you know, very much engaged. My deputy was in Turkey a couple weeks ago. General Allen was there, I think, last week. You know, we're continuing very close communication with the Turks on these issues. And, you know, and it will require an enhanced understanding of the funding networks that we're combating, whether it's the oil networks, other smuggling networks, external donation networks. You know, I should note that we're very proud at the Treasury Department that we have an in-house intelligence agency. We are the only finance ministry in the world that has our own intelligence agency. You know, what these folks do is help us understand the financial networks. They develop financial intelligence. It is enormously important to the effort that the intelligence community help us understand these networks. So, you know, to answer your question, how will we judge our success? I think we will see over time that we are degrading each of these lines of financing for ISIL. You know, as I said, ISIL has a fair amount of money today. What's critically important is that this is, we do everything we can to prevent it from being recurring revenue. You know, one-time revenue that we can address is one thing. What we want to make sure is that, you know, as they have significant expenses, that they don't have a ready stream of recurring revenue.
Let's open it up. We have about 20 minutes, so we'll take questions in batches of three. Please keep it short And please. Yes.
Hi, Mona Shakaki with Al Arabiya. Just a couple of questions. How would you assess what you've done so far? Mm-hmm. And also, you talked about how people in the Gulf, how some governments of the Gulf have new tools that you want to make sure that they know how to use. What are these tools? And also, just the last question, you were talking about how some of the new, you guys have been trying to come up with novel ideas to combat this novel way of raising funds, but really you haven't outlined anything new about what you're talking about. You've always had designations, you've always had looked through other financial networks, so what's new about what you're doing?
Okay. Yes, sir. Yes.
Rahman Jubur with National Endowment for Democracy. You laid out a great strategy for formal sector banking and stuff like this. I just want to raise your attention for other two things we didn't mention. What about informal companies that they are sitting in Turkey and there is a company sitting in Saudi Arabia or in Qatar? I can make 100,000 by phone telling you, give that 100,000, I'll give it to you in Qatar. That's one. Second, one thing you didn't mention, agriculture. If you see just in Iraq, 80% of the wheat and corn produced in Iraq, it is in ISIS area. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about Syria, but that's a lot of money coming in. Did you look in this area?
Let's take a question from the back. Yes, the woman there, please.
Hi, Susan Seltzer from the International Center for Terrorism Studies. A big source or a big method of combating ISIS has been supplying materials and weapons to the Syria rebels and to the Peshmerga. Shouldn't a priority be put on ensuring these supplies do not fall into ISIL hands, which would then put less pressure on their financial coffers?
Okay. Let's start with these.
Great. So how would I assess our progress so far? As I said, we are in the early stages of these efforts. I think some things that we have done, which I do think have been useful, are the designations in September of some of the both the military and financial facilitators, which builds on work that we have been doing for a number of years to identify people who are related to AQI as well as ISIL. There, as I noted, dozens of designations. This helps and, frankly, was useful in my recent trip to the Gulf to highlight work that can be done. This is not going to be a exercise where we are going to, at the end of every month, be able to, produce a balance sheet that shows what ISIL's finances look like. This is going to be a steady effort that will degrade ISIL's financing over time. The other area where I think we have seen, as I noted, we've seen some progress already is not something that we've done at the Treasury Department. It's something that that our colleagues in the Department of Defense and their partners have accomplished in terms of strikes against ISIL oil facilities and oil refineries in particular. That in part impedes their ability to sell refined product, but also makes it more difficult for them to fuel their vehicles, both their military vehicles as well as vehicles that may be smuggling oil. So I think those are efforts. I guess the one other, and this I think comes to your question about sort of what's new, we've also begun conversations with the Iraqi government and with other financial regulatory authorities really around the world about our concerns with the bank branches that are within the ISIL-controlled territory. It is a difficult problem because our interest is not in shutting down all economic activity in the areas where ISIL currently operates. They are, subjugating huge swaths of population, millions of people who are still trying to to live their lives. And, you know, banks, as everybody knows, are important lubricants for the economy. But at the same time, we are very concerned about ISIL's ability to co-opt or coerce the bank employees into, you know, sort of using the banks as a way for them to move money, particularly internationally. And so, I mean, this is sort of, I don't know if it's new or if it's old, but it's a new manifestation of a sort of core Treasury competency, which is working with financial counterparts, both in the Iraqi government and outside, to do what can be done to try and prevent ISIL from making use of these branches. So I leave it at that. On the question of the informal means to move funds, it's absolutely right, and it's something that we confront in all of our counterterrorist financing efforts, is that not everything moves through the formal financial sector. But we also have a history of identifying and taking action against informal financial networks. We've done it in Afghanistan. We've done it in Pakistan. What it requires, as I noted just earlier, is good intelligence on who's involved in these activities and then action against them. And it also requires the cooperation and collaboration with partners in the region. I think the example you cited was, you know, one end of that transaction was in Saudi Arabia. You know, we are, as I noted, you know, very closely engaged with the Saudis on these issues. They are, I think, fully engaged on the effort to combat ISIL financing, and, you know, we will work with partners in the region on those sorts of issues. Both with respect to the question on agriculture and ISIL selling weapons. Look, as I said, one of the challenges here is that ISIL controls territory, and that means that they are, you know, able to engage in activities within the territory where they're currently operating, whether it's stealing crops and selling them, or, you know, coming into weapons that have been left behind and selling them. That's all activity that, you know, we're aware of, that there are ways to address, particularly if it is going beyond the borders where they operate, but fundamentally is going to require pushing back ISIL from the territory where it operates and freeing the lands where they are, as well as, you know, sort of that will work on the extortion networks, will work on the selling of crops that they're stealing. So,
please.
Hi, Rachel Oswald, CQ Roll Call. Could you please talk a little bit about, you said that there had been some success in your conversations with countries, I'm guessing primarily European countries, about no longer paying ransoms to ISIL and other terrorist groups. Could you be more specific about which countries are coming around?
Barbara, please.
Thanks, Marwan. Barbara Slavin from Atlantic Council and from Al Monitor. How do you deal with the fact that there are mixed motivations on the part of the members of the coalition, with many of them putting a priority on getting rid of Bashar al-Assad, and particularly Turkey in this light. And there are many folks who seem to have an ambivalence about the activities of the Islamic State. And if I could also throw in an Iran question, how much progress have you made in setting up financial channels for people who want to do legitimate business with Iran, and will there be a blessed channel between an American and an Iranian bank if we get a comprehensive nuclear agreement? Thank you.
In the back? Well, okay, please.
Sorry. Thank you. Tolga Tanis with Uriyet. I had a quick question regarding this oil trade. You said that some of the oil provided from the territory that ISIL is controlling is sold to Kurds in Iraq and the resold to Turkey. Could you clarify which one, I mean, what what percentage of this oil is crude and what percentage is refined. And also, there are two ways where the Iraqi Kurds are transporting this oil to Turkey. One is through the pipeline, and the second one through the trucks. And the Baghdad government sees that oil trade as a smuggling. What is your position on this issue? When you said that you are working with the partners in the region to choke off cross-border oil smuggling routes, is that including this oil truck trade made between KRG and Turkey?
In the back somewhere. Yes, sir, please.
Will Malden with the Wall Street Journal. Just to follow up on the oil trade, please, you mentioned some fairly well-sized tanker vessels. Has the U.S. or others identified which vessels are being used? What routes are they plying between which ports? And how would they be stopped through being arrested at the ports? Or, you know, the Fifth Fleet on the high seas, how is that particular route going to be stopped? Thank you.
Okay. So I'm going to try and do this in reverse order, just to, for added fun. On your question, Will, I didn't mean to suggest vessels in terms of ships. I think what we've seen are tankers. Truck tankers, not ship tankers. So just to clarify that. And then to respond to this question on how the oil is moving and what the smuggling networks look like and what we're doing about it. Look, I don't have much more detail that I can provide today on the specific routes, the specific mechanisms than what I've already said. But I will note this, that the smuggling routes have existed for a long period of time, long before ISIL was active in the territory. And you know, what may have been a willingness to sort of look the other way, or to be sort of not knowledgeable about the origin of the oil that these smuggling networks are using. And I think these smuggling networks, by the way, you know, it's not just oil. There are other commodities that have, for you know, dozens, hundreds of years, moved through these smuggling networks. But the ability of people, particularly at the end of these networks, to be unaware of the origin of the oil may have been tolerable in a time where what was happening was just, you know, people stealing oil from the Syrian or the Iraqi government and selling it through these networks. What's different is that we now know, and they now know, that this oil begins with ISIL, begins with a terrorist organization, and that the trade in this oil fundamentally funds this terrorist organization. And so what may have been a willingness to look the other way in the past is something that I think cannot continue going forward. And as I said, we will try to emphasize that message both rhetorically and through actions as we identify the people who are involved in those networks. Now, with respect to, you know, competing objectives or ambivalence or what have you, I will leave the diplomacy to the diplomats. You know, I don't sense any ambivalence whatsoever among some of the key partners in the importance of combating ISIL financing. I think, you know, even with respect to, you know, what I was saying on Qatar and Kuwait, neither of those countries, and not the officials in those countries, are saying to me that they are indifferent to the funding of ISIL coming from the territory. It's quite the contrary. I think both of those countries are aware of the problem. And I didn't answer the question about the tools, so let me come back to that, which is that, you know, the Qataris have, as I noted, a new law regarding charities. They have, you know, longstanding legislation that allows them to designate individuals and designate terrorist organizations, as they're obligated to do under UN Security Council resolutions. The Kuwaitis also have both the institutions and the legal framework to do essentially what we do, which is to take administrative action against terrorist financiers. So those are the tools that are available. And, you know, as I said, I think we're going to continue to work with both those jurisdictions so that they employ those tools as effectively as possible. And then on the question about ransoms and where we've had success, I do think it's notable that in the last year plus, you had the G8 come out with a very, very strong statement about the payment of ransoms. And then you've had two UN Security Council resolutions that one specifically focused on ransom payments, and the other in the context of the foreign terrorist fighters, also noting the importance of not paying ransoms to terrorists. That's a very significant declaration of adherence to a no ransoms policy. And then the trick is, and I know you're going to ask me this, the trick is translating that into practice and being committed as a matter of fact to a policy, an approach that, you know, as I noted, is becoming a broader international norm. And, you know, that requires, you know, some very hard choices to be made and recognition of the importance of adopting a no ransoms policy as a means to protect all of our citizens. And, you know, as I noted in my remarks, ISIL received, you know, something on the order of $20 million this year in ransom payments. That means that not everybody is as committed to this no ransoms policy as certainly as we are, and, you know, I would note as the British are too, who I think have like us long adhered to both in word and in practice no ransoms policy. You know, so there's obviously more work to be done on that front also.
Thank you so much. I'm afraid that's all the time we have, so please join me in thanking Undersecretary Cohen for a very timely and interesting presentation.